Hey, yo, check this out. This is Flavor Flav, and you listening to C. Hey, yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you listening to K. Yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you listening to CKUT, and the place to be, and the Bronx POP.
Right along, we have now David Hotchkiss, owner, co-owner? Which, how should we phrase that?
Co-owner.
Co-owner,
yeah,
of BioTrain.
Much nicer. Kindler, gentler.
Yes, well, David and David's lover own BioTrain. And so we're going to talk about being queer, being gay in sort of the business world, the straight world, because you do operate in that world predominantly, I suppose.
Yeah.
Business meetings and the organizing.
Yeah, most definitely, particularly with the new one. I mean, the one that we're building now, hopefully opening in another 3 weeks at La Cité on Park Avenue. Is that a cute little plug?
It's relevant to the interview.
Thank you. The one we basically operate now is in the YWCA, and it's a very nice atmosphere. It's a very nice environment. It's really pretty open, pretty liberal. All of them are. The restaurant business is a really okay industry to be in. It's very pro homo. There's not a lot of I don't know, I guess we do it better than anybody else, it seems. It sort of goes with character of the whole situation. We know how to be nice to people,
and we know how to flair.
Exactly. I mean, it's that queer flair. I mean, it's that little thing. It sounds so stupid, but it's true. I mean, it's all those little extras. I mean, it's the things that I look for, we look for, when we go out somewhere, something that makes it a little special, something a little extra that we added to the whole situation that makes it a really comfortable place. I mean, whether it's service, whether it's food, I mean, they're real important for sure. But I mean, it's the atmosphere, it's the music, it's the people that work behind the counter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is such a plug. I really sound like
No. It's true though. You're talking about the restaurant industry. In general. And the flair anyway that you need, I suppose, in order to succeed, right? There's got to be something that clicks.
I mean, it has to be a little different. It has to, you sort of have to be a little above everybody else. And here I go again, saying a little prejudice, but I think gay people are on the cutting edge of what's happening. And it's a real plug for the whole situation. It seems like everything that's very in and very fashionable with gay people sort of becomes quite fashionable with the straight community 6 months, a year and a half down the road. So it's a matter of trying to maintain the cutting edge. And that's, I hope, what I do, or what we do.
When did you sort of get into the restaurant business? What was happening before that?
I've been in the business for 3 years. This is actually the one we're building now on Park Avenue is actually our third. We have the YWCA is the second. The one in the Guy Metro is our first. Previous to this, I was involved in the shipping industry in a blue collar and a white collar, shirt and tie desk job for 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. And it was a much different situation, a much different environment. It was, I was never blatantly or openly gay, but it was understood. Nobody talked about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it was understood. I did an excellent job, probably much more superior to a lot of the other people. No pat on the back for me that I worked with. But unfortunately, I wasn't married and I didn't have children. And that was a real brick tied around my leg. It held me back. I felt like I was just spinning my wheels and not getting any traction. So I mean, after 10 years in that industry, I decided to get out.
You know, in a way, the most positive thing you can say about that is it was maybe gay tolerant, so long as you didn't
speak
flex
about it. Oh, most definitely. I mean, I had a very good friend who was in the industry with me, a woman who knew I was gay, and she was the one that always fielded questions from people. I mean, that were constantly calling and saying, "Well, do you know, is he gay?" And she'd say, "Well, I don't know. Why don't you ask him yourself?" And I mean, that always put people in their place. I mean, that ultimately put people down. That said, "Well, really, it's none of your business. He does a good job, doesn't he?" "Yes, he does an excellent job." Well, what does the sex aspect, what does sexuality have to play in it? And I bumped into that a lot. I find that plays far too much a role in a lot of industry, in a lot of very homophobic industries, particularly that.
How do you think other gay people deal with, and lesbian people deal with, being in business and being gay, because certainly not all people end up going into business on their own. I mean, I think a lot of people play along in a way.
But I mean, it all depends on the industry you're in, and I'm much more tolerant. I mean, you can be gay or lesbian in like a university environment. I mean, it's very openly accepted. But in industries like, well, the shipping industry that I was in, or a bank industry, it's they're all closeted. They're all very much in the closet. I mean, mm-hmm. people do know they exist, but it's not spoken about. And this is the thing that keeps people back. I mean, as I said before, if they were married, if they led the fairy tale life, I mean, that all mothers and fathers hope their children will grow up to, you know, be married, have the 2.5 children, the dog, the car, the house.
Well, then, you know, that's part of the equation, right? Everything fits in. Yeah. Ah, he fits the profile. Let's move
Most
him.
Definitely.
Let's bump him up.
Most definitely.
Let's bump her up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something that just, I couldn't stand anymore. I couldn't take it anymore. So it was a matter of, for my own personal betterment, my own personal development, I had to get out. I had to do something.
So when you left, did you know you were heading for a restaurant? Had you that plan in mind?
Yeah. I'd never done it before. I'd never done anything like it before. So it was, no, I didn't know anything about it. It's just something I sort of jumped into and fortunately had success.
Mm-hmm.
Success. So, I mean, it was very lucky. It was very lucky.
And you own a franchise. Now, can you operate quite comfortably within that?
Most definitely. I mean, I basically have a part in the entire concept too. I mean, as far as the say is concerned, and the gentleman who owns it is very, very gay tolerant. I mean, mm-hmm. He's seen the job that we've done ultimately, and it's proven that we do very good work, and we sort of have something that a lot of people don't have. I mean, mm-hmm. we have our hands much more on the pulse of what the public wants.
And you know what's really nice about it, David, is that definitely the BioTrain in them. Women's Y has got this reputation. Hey, the staff's all gay.
It really does. Even much more so. They all wear comfortable shoes. I mean, I can't believe it. And it's really nice because the people we have a large gay clientele, most definitely. I mean, particularly from the uh-huh. school across the street too during the year. But uh-huh. even the old ladies that we get in there, and there are a lot of them. I mean, with the seniors groups and the seniors clubs, they just absolutely love everybody. And it's a really nice thing to mm-hmm. see. It's really nice to see the way that they all fuss over these people. And it's a service industry.
That's right. And you are doing a fine job.
Thank you.
That's it, actually.
Great.
How quick that goes, eh? There's a lot more to talk about, actually. But anyways, thanks for giving us this sort of overview as
welcome.
To what it's like.
Thank you.
And what song are we ending with, David? One of your requests, isn't it?
Oh, yes. One of my all-time favorites. It's Elton John and Harmony.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, David.
Hello. We've got a little panel here to talk about gay and lesbian history in Montreal. And my name is Suzanne Downs, and this is Lynn Chamberlain. Lynn is going to be here to talk a little bit about some of the research that she's been doing. Just let us know what it is, Lynn.
It's about lesbians in Montreal during the 50s and the 60s, different aspects of their lives. Bars, literature, what kind of literature they were interested in. What was it like to be a lesbian during that time?
And we've got Ross Higgins, and Ross has been working with the Gay Archives in Montreal for quite some time. And Ross is going to be talking a little bit about the archives.
Uh-huh. I'm not only in the Gay Archives, but I'm also doing research very similar to what Lynn is doing, only I've been talking to older men about their experiences in the gay world of Montreal from about 1950 on.
Okay. And we've got Tom Waugh, who works at Concordia in the film department. And Tom's going to be here plugging the conference that's coming up in 1992, amongst other things.
Yeah, it's a conference in lesbian and gay history with a Montreal urban theme being held at Concordia in Uquam next November 1992. And so I'd maybe like to explain in a little while what's going on with that. And I'm also doing some historical research of my own into gay erotic film and photography up to 1969. And there's lots of that going on in Montreal historically. So that's how that fits in.
Okay. And we're also asking people to call in. And the number is 398-4616. It's 398-4616. And before we got together to start the show, everybody decided that I should talk about bars I don't know why. And also a little bit about L'Androgyne, well, one of Montreal's the most famous gay and lesbian bookstore in Montreal, where I worked for quite some time. But I, of course, would like to start off with other people talking. Lynn, could you just let us know a little bit about your research and what it is that you've been talking, who have you been talking to, and what you've been able to find out?
Yes, well, I've talked to older lesbians, mainly women who are 40 or 50 or 60 years old. And most of them told me that they had nothing to say about that time because there was nothing going on. But when I've met them, they had a lot to say. I cannot tell you everything in a few minutes.
How did you find the women?
I've asked friends and friends of friends, and I've tried to have women from different classes who had different kind of jobs, because it was very important at that time what kind of jobs you had. But just by asking, and it was harder to get older women because they are... they don't know you. They're not in the lesbian community. They are quite isolated. They don't perceive themselves as lesbian or name themselves as lesbian. So it's harder to meet them. Mm-hmm. Women from 70, 75 up. And
yeah. It seems it's very hard to find women for lots of reasons. We've been largely invisible. There's not all that much documentation on us. And the same is true for gay men as well. It's very hard to find history books, for example. We have to sort of search through and try to find clues, and we're referred to in different ways, and you learn to read between the lines. And it seems to me you were doing some research along with Ross into some of the yellow newspapers, the tabloids.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't call them tabloids, really. They were the yellow newspapers that we studied, particularly one that was called Ici Montréal. It was sort of the classic one. It was printed on yellow newsprint. It was a sort of 8.5 by 11 format, the kind of cheapest kind of printing and so on. And Lynn and I did an analysis of about 18 issues of a collection in a collection that I found in a used bookstore a few years ago. And we found that on the average, each issue had about 7 items, whether they were little gossip tidbits or ads for people who wanted to meet others of the same sex, scattered among many other ads for heterosexuals looking to meet somebody, and a few feature articles. They had things like, there's one in particular that I was thinking of talking about today, about a man who was arrested who had tried to pick up a police officer and take him back to a rooming house.
What year was that?
It was 1956. And he eventually got off because they couldn't prove the charges. The thing that we found mostly in these items was often that although the attitudes being expressed in these straight newspapers was very negative, that sometimes there would be little bits of information, because at that time, of course, there was no gay movement in Montreal. There was very little access for people who were interested in finding the gay world because they were attracted to people of the same sex. So sometimes, like in this story, they talk about the fact that they met at a tavern on St. Lawrence near St. Catherine. So from reading that, somebody would have known, well, that was a place to look.
Yeah. And it's almost as if we've always been circling around in sort of a demi-monde, and you had to be in the know, at least have an idea of where to look to find out where people were. And you were talking about different women from different class backgrounds. There must have also been that same kind of situation for everybody. I imagine if people were upper class or they had a lot of money, the places that they would meet would be very different, let's say, from where working class people would meet, probably for a lot of reasons in terms of the amount of money that they had, and also in mm-hmm. terms of the options that were open to them as well.
Yeah, but also the consequences of being visible as a lesbian. If you went to the bar, there were no lesbian-only bars, so they were a mixed bar. So if you go there can be other people, straight people who are there, who can see you and see then that you are a lesbian. What I found is that lesbians who went to the bars were working-class lesbians only. Lesbians who work as teacher or nurses never went there, or they went there once or twice, but they were too much afraid of being recognized by their students or ex-students. And if they were seen in a bar, they could lose their job. And it was not the same thing in factory. I mean, they don't care what you do at night. Mm-hmm. But in the school, you had to To be careful and present a facade of heterosexuality and morality and good morality. That was an important difference. And a ritual lesbian could rent places, go to Paris, go to Capri, have their own house and parties in their own houses. So they could have a lesbian life, but you didn't see them. Mm-hmm. It was an invisible network.
Yeah. What was the first reference to, or the earliest reference to homosexuality that you've ever found in some of the research you've done?
Well, there was someone who gave us a clipping at the archives a few years ago. In fact, it was a reprint of an original clipping from La Presse from 1886, which is the story of Clovis Villeneuve, a man who was cruising on the Champ de Mars down what's now the parking lot behind City Hall. And in this report, the journalist gives, in very sarcastic tones, a description that allows us to see that there was, in fact, a homosexual society in Montreal at that time, because he discusses the clothes, the very elegant clothes of these tall, thin men who were slipping in and out of the rows of poplar trees and calling to each other in honeyed tones, and so on, before he ends up with the story of an entrapment arrest of this Clovis Villeneuve. I've never been able to follow up on the story to find out what happened to him, but he got a fine of $20. So that was 1886. After that, we have very little information up until the 1950s, and even then it's fairly scattered.
So what are the kinds of material do you have in the archives, Ross, and how do you get the material? Do people give donations?
People give donations, yes. I mean, to some extent, if I have an idea of where there should be a story, like some... from my interviews, if I have a kind of vague date, I will go to the microfilms and pour my eyes into the microfilm reader. Terrible way of doing research, but just to try and build up our documentation. One other thing that just in terms of the class distinction in the gay world, there is a very, very wonderful source of documentation. There was a thesis done in sociology here at McGill in 1954 by a man named Morris Lesnoff, called The Homosexual in Urban Society, which is a study of gay life, gay men in Montreal at that time. And the major conclusion that he came to was a class distinction, really, what he talks about in terms of occupational difference. He found even in terms of his own research that the what he calls the overts, the lower class men, were much more willing to talk to him than the coverts, who were more of the professional type. And this had a big impact on their lives as well. The thesis is really documentation of the lives of Robert, who was a part-time hospital cleaner, and about 12 friends who met at Robert's apartment regularly, like virtually every night of the week. And Mr. Lesnoff hung out with them for about 8 months and made copious notes on their conversations. So we have this really wonderfully rich source of information on gay men's lives at the time.
And do you have slides and posters and things like that from different events or from dances? It seems to me
yes.
That at one time we were always doing dances and everybody was collecting the posters. But now...
I wish we'd been more zealous in those days, because in the 70s, you know, we were having all the dances as the gay movement was just really getting off the ground in Montreal. And we have a relatively good collection, but I'm sure there's things that we don't have. If anybody has anything that they would like to donate, I would certainly be happy to have donations.
Tom, I seem to remember that you went down to California and spent a summer doing research in the Kinsey Institute. I know that you were really intent on doing a very good amount of research, because you came back and you weren't tanned at all.
It's true, and I've been indulging again this summer. As you notice, I'm quite pale.
Do they have the largest collection of erotic
photographs?
It's not
in California, but this is what I've been trying to do, look at these archival collections of old movies and photographs and try to make some sense of them. And what I did this summer was some interviews with quite elderly men who in the 40s, 50s, and 60s used to make this stuff, which I think has really been underestimated in its importance in the formation of a modern gay male community in North America. Speaking of Montreal, even here, there was quite a network of studios that produced mostly photographs and magazines in the late 1950s, early 60s, that would be sold internationally, but would reflect local models, local photographers, and it was quite a profitable little business. One of the, they were, the magazines were in English, but very often the models, these young bodybuilders, were French Canadian. And so it's sort of an interesting document of that period. Some of the magazines were called Face and Physique.
Were they the precursor to Ben Weider's magazines, yeah, now the Muscle Mags? And he tries, yeah, to disavow any sort of connection.
I think, like, Ben Weider and other kind of straight entrepreneurs, mm-hmm, eventually took over the little gay magazines. But for a time there, they were really flourishing. And
they were small, weren't they, in, mm-hmm, the beginning? They, mm-hmm, were sort of like pamphlet, mm-hmm, size?
And they were very coy, too, because you had to be to avoid trouble with the post office and the police. But nowadays, they seem very, very obvious. They're quite erotic, even though they give you little tips on bench presses and weightlifting and things. You know where their real interest is, and it's not in the biceps.
They were quite well known at the time, because in the yellow newspapers that we studied, there's one or two little items about Vim, and I forget what the other title was, another American one that was very popular among the petit monsieur, as they like to call male homosexuals.
I was telling you earlier that I phoned up this morning a guy who was on the cover of Vim in 1940. I called him up in Florida this morning, and he hung up on me. He said he didn't want to discuss it. So this kind of research is full of difficulties.
Were the same models, did they reappear often, or was it really quite a large range of people who were posing for the magazines? Do you know, just from looking at
them? There were lots of new talent. I think these photographers would hang around the YMCA and photograph anyone who was willing, or some of the people I met in California would just take their camera to the beach
and take
pictures, yeah, or hang out at the bus station. And as people would come into town, take them home and photograph them and then publish the picture in the magazine.
Yeah. We'll just remind you again that we'd like you to call in if you have anything to add about gay and lesbian history in Montreal at 398-4616. That's 398-4616. Lynn, it's too bad we didn't have any of those kind of magazines, as I remember, in the 70s. In fact, we were pretty puritanical about what we thought as lesbians that we should be publishing in magazines. It was, and I know now lots of people think that it was pretty much anti-sex, but I don't think it was that as much as was an attempt to redefine what sexuality meant for us as lesbians. Because when I look at, you know, make a comparison now of some of the material that's available, like On Our Backs and different things like that, to, well, not Lesbian Tide, because that was mostly a news magazine, but some of the other ones like Sinister Wisdom, it seems to me that there was a lot of erotica. It's as if we were really searching for a way to express ourselves, but it's as if we set ourselves really narrow parameters about what was supposed to be good and what was supposed to be bad. And I find it interesting now. It seems to have opened up a little bit, but I don't know if things are just cyclical and we're mm-hmm. just coming back, or mm-hmm. if we're really forging ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was understandable at that time, because lesbian was related to prostitution and all kind of illicit sex. And the image of the lesbian was super sexy, a woman who was ready to do anything to have sex. So that was not the only image, but that was one of the image of the lesbian. And the lesbian bars were located in the same part of the city where you could find the prostitutes. And many lesbian bars were frequented also by prostitutes. So many lesbians of the time and younger lesbians didn't want to, since we were still into a butch femme role, and had,
which has made a big comeback now.
Yeah, and you had younger feminist lesbian and didn't mix really, but they didn't understand each other, I think.
No,
like when I was there, I remember that one butch asked me if she could dance with my lover at the time, and we just left. We didn't understand at all what was happening, and there was no contact between the two generations.
Yeah, well, I remember one of the first bars I went to was Les Ponts de Paris on Saint-André, and it was astonishing for me, because I had just discovered feminism, and I had a very different idea of who I wanted to be, and I was shocked when I went into the bar. Well, for all sorts of reasons. I was scared about going into a lesbian bar. There was a big bouncer. He almost looked like a penguin standing at the door.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what to do, and I went with two women who had been there very often. In fact, one of them had worked as like a bus girl there,
mm-hmm.
and I remember going in and looking around, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's like my mother was sitting there, because there were some women who really did resemble my mother, and I felt totally out of place for all sorts of reasons, though. My background was a little bit different. My French wasn't very good at the time, and I was just plainly terrified. And I remember I went into the bathroom. We used to go there, and we would close the bar, and I went into the bathroom once, and you had to give a quarter to the woman in order to get your toilet paper. But I didn't know the etiquette at all. And when I, you know, she sold combs and watches and chips and all sorts of things like
that. But you learned very fast.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I walked in there, and there was a bit of a scuffle. Like an altercation was happening, and this woman had to take care of it. Mm-hmm. And I really had to pee really badly. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? And so I go into the stall. I come back out. She's still preoccupied. I didn't want to interrupt her, tap her on the shoulder, say, oh, here's my quarter. Mm-hmm. So I zipped out. And from that time on, I was so frightened to go in there in case she was going to say to me, you never paid me for the last time. So I developed an amazing bladder control, and I used to be there all night. And then we'd go out to St. Denis Street, and we'd have stuffed chicken sandwiches and French fries with sauce. Yeah. But that was the first bar I went to, along with Babyface, above the All-American, which is used to be on Dorchester, which is now René Lévesque. Mm-hmm. And that was a trip in and of itself. Again, it was a whole learning process for me, because I kept looking for women who were like me. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find them. I found women who were lesbians, it's true. But it's just not enough. It wasn't exactly what I was looking for. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't know if I can live this kind of life. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally discovered L'Androgyne, that was a revelation to me. It was really important. I thought, oh, phew. Mm-hmm. Finally, I found a place where I can be. Mm-hmm.
Well, you had to know the rules in the bars. You had to know that you had to pay at this. You had to address to the butch first. And if you didn't respect those rules, then you could have some troubles. And many lesbians weren't used to go to clubs anyway. They were afraid for all kinds of reasons, even in straight clubs. So they didn't go, that's all. Or they did go once, but they never came back.
I also remember at that time, I found out later there was Madame Arthur's, and I would have loved to have gone there if I had only known that it had existed, but I didn't know anything about it. And I think that's when gay liberation started and feminism was really starting to gain some force. And so we started to have dances. And I remember the first dance I went to was in the old Powerhouse Gallery on Saint-Dominique Street. I remember coming all the way from Ville d'Anjou. I was still living with my parents. And I go walking past, and I hear this music, and it's upstairs. It's about three flights up. And I thought, oh, will I go in? Will I go in? And I go round the block and round the block again. I step into the door. I start to go up the first flight of stairs. And I thought, no way. I can't go in. Turn around, went all the way home. I was so disappointed with myself. But the next week, there was another dance. And I came there, and I was determined to go in. And I did. I go up this whole, you know, big flight of stairs. And I see in the lobby that there's, like, women there. And I just thought, oh, my gosh, what will I do? Mm-hmm. And but I met women there who I still know today. And that was a lot of fun for me, because I found the whole atmosphere was very, very different than what I had experienced in the bars. Although I still, now I've started to go out to the bars again, and it's a whole new story. I still like disco, I admit it.
During that period when you started going to bars, I guess L'Androgyne was the only place that where men and women worked together at the time. Is that true? Because I don't think in Montreal there's this tradition in gay and lesbian community of this kind of collaboration.
I didn't hear what you said. People were talking to me.
I think that's true in general, in the movement for sure. I mean, there have been places, but not very much from what I could find out about men and women sharing bar space. But
it was really segregated. I think part of it is because of the Quebec culture being Catholic. It's okay to have women's bars and men's bars. And also there was a very big lesbian separatism movement as well. Mm-hmm. But there were different splits all the way down the line. There's English, French, there's different classes, and especially women, men. And I think now it's a new wave now is to have more mixed bars. Part of it may have to do with AIDS as well. I'm not quite sure with men and women wanting to spend more time together. We've got a phone call, though. So why don't you pick it up, Tom?
I don't think we're supposed to pick it up.
Pick it up?
Pick it up?
No?
No.
Hello? You just hung up on him. Call back. Call back. This is really amateur hour. We're not very used to doing this. But what we'll do is we'll go to a musical break. We've got Miss Otis Regrets by Christy McCall from the Red Hot and Blue album. Okay, we're back. That was Miss Otis Regrets.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I wanted to say something about that song. It was sung by Suzy Solidar, which was a very well-known lesbian, a French singer. Mm-hmm. And she was quite well-known as a lesbian, and she came to sing at the Ritz Café in Montreal a few times in 49 and somewhere during the 50s. And I don't think that she sang lesbian songs in the Ritz Cafe, but she had very erotic songs that she sang. She had the lesbian bars in Paris and in the south of France. And there she sang lesbian poetry. She read lesbian poetry and sang lesbian songs.
Oh, it was the
including this one.
It was the folk at the station who picked it out, so it was a good choice. And we've got a caller now, so if you just press that button. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about the history of Montreal.
Okay.
What I'm wondering is like, in a city like, say, Toronto, you have a real division between the lesbian and gay communities. And I'm wondering how that plays out in a city like this, where you also have divisions between the Francophone and the Anglophone communities. Like, I see a real division between gays and lesbians as Anglophones, and also the gay and lesbian communities linguistically. They all seem to separate themselves into four different camps and act, in terms of activism, they act quite differently. And I'm wondering if, how that ties in historically with the city.
Ross, do you want to?
Well, I can answer a little bit. I think that perhaps the separations are more true now than they were historically, because, for one thing, the gay world was so small in the past. And my impression personally is that gay people have much more tendency to be bilingual than the population as a whole. So certainly in terms of the bar world, there was a great deal of overlap. And that, after all, to go home with somebody, all you have to do is get the basic message across. So you don't really need to speak the other language fluently. In the movement, there has been, there were sort of phases of the movement. The first part of the gay movement for men started in 1971 with the Front Libération Homosexuelle, which obviously was a basically Francophone group, although there were Anglophones that worked with it. That collapsed in June of 1972 when the police raided their opening party on their new office space down on St. Catherine. And then sort of the torch was picked up by Gay McGill, which was formed in, I think it was the fall of 1972 and carried on until about 1975 with having the huge dances at the McGill Student Union, which attracted up to about 2,000 people.
They were some of the biggest dances in North America at the time.
Yeah. And then the Francophone movement came back in the mid-70s and particularly got going once there was a whole series of raids and a cleanup campaign before the Olympic Games in 76. That was sort of the beginning of a modern phase of the gay movement. It was mostly Francophones, but I mean, I've always worked with it myself, and there were a few of us there. So.
Yeah, but it was ADGQ, and we had to work really hard to get the L added on.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of truth in what the caller is saying. It's funny, I thought that in Toronto, things were better organized and the people were closer together in terms of the communities for, well, one of the reasons, because people mostly do speak English. I don't know if people are, I think there's something to do with class as well. I mean, last summer, after the gay bashing and the sex garage raids, I was astounded to attend meetings where so few people spoke French. I was really amazed. And what occurred to me is that many of the people, anyone who was Francophone, usually was able to do their own translation. They had a tendency to be more bilingual. But I think part of it is lots of people do come in from out of province to go to school here. Sometimes the rates are cheaper and different things like that. And so what you have is you have a lot of activism that does come from the universities, and people don't know how to speak French yet. And you need a certain amount of time, I think, to learn how to speak French, because the divisions amongst the community, I think, loom very large still. And sometimes I think it's almost ridiculous, because there are so few of us that we might as well all get together to work together and to achieve a common goal. But we also have different goals, and our realities are different as well in terms of what lesbians might think to be important or what gay men might think to be important. Sometimes we have to find a common point that we can all rally around. But it's not always, I think, as simple as that.
In terms of gay and lesbian studies, actually, this conference is looking good in those terms as a collaboration between Concordia and NUQAM. I think it's really pioneering a certain kind of almost intellectual collaboration that hasn't been very common in the past, and institutional collaboration as well. And hopefully something will really come of it.
it's also an important collaboration between men and women going to be in the conference in November 1992. Because up to now, aside from androgyny, as far as I can think, there aren't that many cases. I think Quebec is different from the rest of North America because elsewhere in 1977, when Anita Bryant mounted her campaign against gay civil rights in Florida, the whole sort of reactionary attack on gay rights forced men and women in places like Toronto to work together, at least in temporary coalitions, and established network connections between men and women that were never forced here.
Yeah, we've been a bit passive, I think, since we've had our rights ostensibly protected under the Charter here in Quebec. We have another caller, though. Hello, you're on the air. Oops, did you lose them? Try again. Oh. Well, we're not very good at this. We're going to try again. Okay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good. I think this is very interesting, your program, that you're discussing lesbian and gay participation together in the community, working together. And I just wanted to tell you, you made a comment about why people are sort of, I think, tendencies to try to get to be together in bars more today, and you said maybe it's the AIDS thing, and in Montreal, at least, I think the police discrimination had a lot to do with it anyway. At least the birth of something that was called DDQ when it happened in the jungle last summer, when the lesbians and gay men got together and said no more discriminatory door policies. And I think that activism has certainly brought about a lot of more awareness of political correctness in the community. And the infighting that goes on, perhaps, in the gay male and lesbian community is more, I think, a question of educating ourselves. We can stand together and educate the straight population. And I think it's progressive. It needs to be done in this town.
No, I think I agree with you in terms of we do have to talk to each other. And I found it quite ironic to find out that political correctness has become so important in terms of the mainstream media, and that they're starting to talk about it, because it's something that when we were working the collective at L'Androgyne, that was a constant in our everyday lives. We went through so many different meetings trying to figure out what was the best way to go about this. And people had so many different views. We had, two women who were there specifically because they were lesbian separatists and they were making this compromise to work with men. We had to work really hard at that time, I think, to recognize the Francophone fact, because most of us were all English speaking. And so we did all our meetings in French. And it was actually quite a revelation to me to find out that, it's something that we keep talking about, and we're not past it yet, because we keep learning as we go on. And now we're starting to, I think, as a culture, because Quebec is pretty white, to talk about racism, talk about different cultures as well, because we know just by the simple fact that we're gay or lesbian, that's something we have in common, but we're still a very, very diverse group.
But political correctness was always a kind of tongue-in-cheek concept, wasn't it? And it just sort of stood for a kind of heightened sensitivity to process and to representation and to empowerment of individuals within a group, a recognition of difference. But the way it's being bandied about now by Maclean's and all the other reactionary media is as some kind of censorship. Which is a complete reversal of what it used to be.
Well, sure. I think everybody has a different idea of what's politically correct to them. And I know we used to just sort of roll our eyes at one point and say, oh, I can't be any more politically correct than I am. And I used to find that the gay men I was working with were more politically correct than me.
Because, I have to laugh at that.
No, but in the context, they were, because they had their awareness of feminism was different from mine, I think. I wasn't as afraid of saying something that another woman might take in a different, badly or something mm-hmm. like that. And they were much more conscious about their behavior. They're very well-trained gay men of a certain age, I think.
Well, as a former member of the Androgyny Collective at that time, I could certainly attest to the fact that we had a very good education in respecting women's point of view and allowing women space to express themselves and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember once we were carrying some material that was for lesbians only, and it was very hard for us to get this material. We had to promise them that no, men wouldn't see it, they wouldn't touch it, not even the men working there.
We looked, of course.
Yes.
You did.
I didn't know you did that, but I remember once Paul was working and somebody came into the store and insisted on buying, this man wanted to buy a copy of What Lesbians Do, was it, or Nomadic Women? Lesbian,
yes.
Nomadic Women, which was this very kind of beige book on lesbian sex.
Beige book of lesbian sexuality.
With blind drawings. And Paul did something that I never would have thought of doing. He said, well, if that's your attitude, it's not for sale to anyone. Picks up the whole pile and puts it in the bathroom, and that was the end of that. I think I would have sold it to the guy anyway, just to get him out of the store.
But you I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think the Montreal, particularly Montreal gay and lesbian community, is headed in the future as far as working together is concerned?
Well, geez, that's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure. It's a lot of people are working very hard around AIDS, and I know that we're starting to try to have a bit more understanding of, as women, how we're affected by AIDS, because normally we're at the bottom of the list in terms of any kind of research that's going to be done. I know that there's a tremendous problem in terms of translation. There always has been. One of the reasons why things seem to take a little bit longer to gel here is that unless you have access or you read English material, it takes so long for things to be translated, and especially information about AIDS. Our government has been pretty reactionary in terms of advertising or making information available or accessible. And I think a lot of it is going to depend on whether or not we're going to decide that Quebec becomes independent so that we can get that done, and then we can start focusing on the problems that we're all facing. So I'm not quite sure. I think it bodes well. And I do like the kind of discussions that we've been having lately, especially in spite of the fact that sometimes people get a little bit cranky with each other and get upset.
Yes, 1-2-1-2. Oh yeah, see, Nomadic Massive in the place to be. You're listening to CKUT 90.3. Understand?
Thank you. cœur à cœur avec toi, CKUT 90,3 FM. CKUT, heart to heart with you.
À toutes avec un crisse de gros E, à cause que c'est toujours bien la base d'essayer d'inclure tout le monde.
La très bienvenue dans ce nouvel épisode de la deuxième saison de votre podcast Queer Féministe Interrégional et le plus intersectionnel possible préféré. À chaque épisode, on se garoche dans un thème qui nous intéresse vivement, à la vitesse où revole la toast que Flavien essaye d'attraper avec son quête de gouleur dans le Romano Fafard. La fois qu'il y a une toast qui va vraiment vite dans le Romano Fafard.
Cette vitesse-là!
C'est disponible sur YouTube, tous les épisodes de Dans une guerre exprès de chez vous, si vous vous en rappelez pas. Donc, ce fameux thème qui nous intéresse vivement, on l'observe avec nos lunettes nerd radicales de presque trentenaires, ben à bout de ce monde-là qu'on travaille à chimer à grands coups de podcast.
Dans le fond, là, tout ou pantoute, c'est comme la communauté qui soutient Frodon qui rush dans sa quête d'aller jeter l'hostie d'anneau dans le Mordor.
L'hostie d'anneau. Bon, aujourd'hui, on parle de féminisme queer dans la science-fiction et dans la fantasy avec Leila Sofiane, puis on part sur toutes sortes de chires de notre bord, nous autres aussi, bien évidemment.
On est